Thanks for sticking with us, or if you're just joining, you're listening to Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati. In a mission of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. I'm Stephen J. Lowenstein, and I'll continue with the second half of this week's edition of the Greater Cincinnati Business Report. And we'll kick off with a Business Pulse survey asking the question, how protected is your business against a cyber attack? And the results were given in a bar form, and they are as follows. We have a dedicated staff here to protect us. 10% of the respondents chose that. 14% chose we outsource to third-party vendors for protection. We have cybersecurity insurance coverage. 5% chose that. We have training, regular training, on best practices was the response given by 5%. 31% chose two of the above. 17 chose three of the above. And 17% also chose all of the above. It was at this point, a rather small sampling of only 189 respondents. Now, whenever I see the topic of our next article in the pages of the Courier, I always report on it because it's of interest to me, and I have a feeling it is of interest to many in our audience. It's how Kroger's prices compare to Walmart. And Kroger Company put an aggressive promotions in place in one of its key markets to cut prices last quarter, narrowing the premium it charges over Walmart. Kroger's best prices, including promotions, were 13.5% higher than those at Walmart last quarter. That's according to a study of grocery prices of Las Vegas, Denver, and Minneapolis, conducted by Chris Mandeville, an analyst with Jefferies. Now, the best prices at Kroger, the nation's largest operator of traditional supermarkets, improved by 1 percentage point relative to Walmart's prices, Mandeville found. Most of the price improvement came from Kroger's aggressive promotions in Las Vegas, he said. Kroger cut its best prices on a sampling of products by 5.8% in Las Vegas last quarter, while Walmart cut prices on the same items by just 3.6%. However, Kroger's everyday prices rose by 3.2 percentage points, as compared with Walmart's during the quarter. Walmart's prices are now 20.1% lower, the biggest price gap on everyday prices in 4.5 years. Kroger's best prices also rose relative to Walmart's over the past year. Walmart made deeper price cuts, a point of concern for Mandeville. This now marks the second consecutive check in these markets, where Kroger's everyday best price gaps have expanded, and 5 of 6 months in 2019 where we've seen worsening year-over-year results, Mandeville wrote. Kroger management told Mandeville last month it plans to focus more on everyday low pricing on some of its products in an effort to boost same-store sales. Kroger has invested more than $4 billion in cutting prices since 2001, a trend that has continued lately. CEO Rodney McMullen has said Kroger prices have to be competitive with Walmart so its service and product selection advantages give shoppers a better value. Now, Kroger continues to build market share. It had a 48.1 share of the grocery industry in Greater Cincinnati in spring, That's up from 42.5 a year ago, according to Chain Store Guide. Walmart was second with just 16%, down from 18.1%. Kroger, which has 2,800 stores in 35 states, ranked first in 8 of its 10 largest markets, and second in the other two. Since we're talking about prices, sales, and such, let's continue on that theme with this article about Macy's. And their CEO explains how Trump tariffs are impacting prices. Macy's CEO Jeff Gennette told investors on Wednesday that upcoming tariffs against China announced by President Donald Trump could potentially impact both prices and his company's earnings. Gennette, in an investor call following Macy's second quarter earnings release, said that Trump planned 10% tariffs on some $300 billion worth of Chinese goods could lower his company's earnings by 5 cents per share. Macy's expects to report full-year 2019 earnings per share between $2.85 and $3.05. That itself was lowered Wednesday when Macy's reported disappointing second-quarter results that included earnings per share of 28 cents, far lower than the average analyst estimate of 45 cents per share. The latest rounds of tariffs was scheduled to be enacted on September 1st, before Trump delayed them until December the 15th, with the stated purpose of allowing retailers to stock up in advance of the holiday season. Goods slated for duties include footwear and apparel, toys, food and kitchen items, chemicals, fireworks, baby products, sports equipment, electronics, video game consoles, laptops, and cell phones. Despite the hit to earnings, Gennette said he does not plan to pass on the added expense from tariffs to consumers. Trump had imposed 3 tranches of tariffs on Chinese goods in an escalating trade war with the planet's second-largest economy. Gennette said the first 2 rounds did not impact Macy's business, but tranche 3, a tariff of $200 billion on Chinese goods, raised from 10 to 25% on May 10th, did cause Macy's to raise some of its prices. Gennette said Macy's played with limited price increases on luggage, housewares, and limited furniture items. We learned from those experiences that the customer had very little appetite for price increases, he said. That informed its decision on what to do if the 4th tranche is imposed on the 15th of December. We are looking at no price increases on any content that is touched by a tranche 4, Gennette said. Macy's is working with its vendors, its manufacturers, and sourcing partners to mitigate the impact of tariffs as long as those tariffs are no more than 10%, Trump had announced. When it goes to 25%, you're dealing with a whole other series of dynamics that I would not say we wouldn't have to raise prices, Gennette said. Macy's operates 863 stores under the nameplates Macy's, Macy's Backstage, Bloomingdale's, Bloomingdale's Outlet, Blue Mercury, and Story, primarily in the United States. It reported $24.9 billion in revenue in 2018. Macy's employs 3,600 in Cincinnati between 2 offices, a basic call center, and 6 retail locations. From the Banking and Financial Services section of the paper, Regal's public company could be close to making a big acquisition. The $300 billion public company, ex-Procter & Gamble Company executive Ed Regal formed nearly 2 years ago, could be close to acquiring a company. Legacy Acquisition Corporation is seeking an extension to its 2-year deadline to acquire a company, according to a proxy statement filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Why might that indicate a deal is near? Because Legacy sought an extension of just 2 months, giving it until January the 1st to wrap up the deal. Most similar companies that seek extensions look for at least 3 months, and they request them closer to the deadline. Christy Marvin, a former investment banker who founded the SPAC Insider online industry publication, Legacy deadline to make an acquisition is November the 21st. Marvin said it's rare that a special purpose acquisition companies or SPAC such as Legacy seek a deadline extension so far ahead of the actual deadline. That might indicate a deal could be announced soon. Deals take about 4 to 5 months to be completed once they're announced, so the extended deadline would coincide with the time needed for a deal that gets announced soon. But in case Legacy needs extra time, it's also requesting the option to extend the deadline 4 times by 30 days each through May the 20th. Shareholders are scheduled to vote on the deadline extension October the 8th. SPACs have no operations. They sell stock to raise money specifically so they could buy other companies. Legacy raised $300 million in November of 2017 in an IPO. It's required to put at least 80% of that money, or $240 million, to work through an acquisition or acquisitions by the November 21st deadline. If it doesn't, and shareholders don't approve the deadline extension, then it has to return the money to investors. Marvin speculates a deal is based on Legacy's filing. They're coming very close to a deadline. They filed a proxy statement, and they should have a deal soon, she said. Regal, who is Legacy CEO, said he couldn't comment. Now, Legacy went public at $10 a share. That raised $300 million as an SPAC. It plans to invest in a company in the consumer packaged goods, consumer durables, retail, or restaurant chain industries. Regal told me last year when I wrote a cover story about him and Legacy. Legacy stock closed trading Thursday unchanged for the day at $10.16. Marvin said Regal's P&G background and experience should make Legacy successful. You're selling the team, she said, of SPACs as they seek investors because they don't have an active operation to tout. The fact that he has industry knowledge and a good Rolodex should make it sustainable. Turning back to the pages of technology, we're going to talk about Madoff. Remember him? Well, a Madoff whistleblower accuses GE of fraud, setting its stock down. General Electric Company lost more than $8 billion in value Thursday morning after a researcher who called out Bernie Madoff's fraud scheme had published a 175-page report claiming GE had committed tens of billions of dollars in undisclosed accounting fraud. Harry Markopoulos, an accounting investigator with Boston Ties, said he and a team of researchers had discovered $38 billion in fraud at GE, calling the alleged cover-up a bigger fraud than Enron. While GE took a multi-billion dollar hit on its long-term care insurance business last year, It still failed to disclose massive and ever-increasing losses from the business, Markopoulos said. He also accuses GE of hiding billions of dollars of losses related to its investment in oil field services company, Baker Hughes. GE's cash holdings are in far worse shape than it let on in its annual report, he added. Now, Markopoulos is best known for warning securities regulators about Madoff's investment scheme years before Madoff's arrest and conviction. For the GE report, he's working with an unnamed hedge fund and has bet the company's share price will decline, and he will receive a portion of that fund's investment gains, the Wall Street Journal reported. A GE spokesman called Markopoulos' allegations meritless in a statement Thursday. The company has never met, spoken to, or had contact with Mr. Markopoulos. We are extremely disappointed that an individual with no direct knowledge of GE would choose to make such serious and unsubstantiated claims, she said. GE operates at the highest levels of integrity, stands behind its financial reporting. As of 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Thursday, GE's share price was down by more than 12% of the day, trading at $7.90 per share. It's fallen as low as $7.65 per share. Markopoulos is based in Boston, the Wall Street Journal reported. He worked for Boston's Rampart Investment Management Company, served as the chair of the CFA Society of Boston in the early 2000s before becoming an independent fraud investigator. According to the report, he first became suspicious of GE's accounting while attending educational luncheons at the CFA Society of Boston in the late 1990s. GE Aviation, a subsidiary of GE Base in Evendale, is the region's third-largest manufacturer, with 808,400 employees. That's according to Courier Research. It produces aircraft engines, marine and industrial turbines. GE Aviation is also GE's highest-grossing division. Now for some news about Fifth Third Bank. Here's why the bank is expanding in San Francisco. Fifth Third Bank Corp. told the Courier's sister publication in the San Francisco Business Times on Wednesday the nation's 18th largest bank will soon have a more robust presence in the Bay Area. Today, the Cincinnati-based bank has virtually no presence in the region. Fifth Third, led by CEO Greg Carmichael, also said Wednesday that its Fifth Third Securities Incorporated unit hired Timothy Beach, Ari Citrin, and Oliver Jansen as managing directors to lead its newly created renewable energy investment banking group. The team will remain based in San Francisco. Previously, Fifth Third had less than 5 employees working remotely in the Bay Area. This announcement of the hiring of an investment banking team marks a more robust presence, including physical office space. It's part of a larger strategic build-out to come for this market, the third spokesperson, Shandy Huber, said. Asked whether Bay Area residents will soon see Fifth Third branches in their region, Huber said, "We're always evaluating how to best serve prospective customers and clients. The time comes that we feel our clients need this in San Francisco, we'll evaluate it." Fifth Third has a process for entering emerging markets, which typically begins with a commercial banking presence. For the time being, we are committed to establishing a critical mass in the local commercial market, Huber said. Maybe the first time San Francisco has been called an emerging market since 1848, but it might take time for the Ohio Bank to get to know the region. With $147 billion in assets, Fifth Third is among the nation's major banks going national, or strengthening existing coast-to-coast branch networks, entering new markets with branches. Bank of America, for instance, recently entered Ohio with branches by opening its first location in Greater Cincinnati. B of A branch openings are also planned for Columbus and Cleveland. J.P. Morgan Chase is also strengthening its national branch network by opening its first branches in Charlotte, Philadelphia, Boston, Nashville, and other cities. Get a list of the top 50 to 75 cities in America. Look at the ones we're not in, and assume one day we'll be in all of them, Chase Chairman and CEO Jamie Dimon said last year. J.P. Morgan Chase, B of A, Wells Fargo, three of the nation's largest banks, are prevented from acquiring other banks by regulations tied to their substantial size. Pittsburgh-based PNC Financial Services Group, which operates the nation's sixth-largest bank, PNC Bank, recently embarked on building a coast-to-coast retail branch network. The expansion began in Dallas and Kansas City, Missouri, with the new sites growing at nearly five times the pace we expected from our legacy markets, PNC Chairman and CEO William Demchak recently told investors. Over the next 18 months or so, PNC will accelerate branch openings in Boston, Dallas, Houston, and Nashville. We have not discussed plans beyond that at this time, a PNC spokeswoman said. But that might just be a matter of time. Our ambition is to be a national retail bank, the PNC CEO told investors. Fifth Third and PNC's ambitions to be national players could make a wide range of Bay Area banks more attractive acquisition targets, as it's hard to be a national player in banking and ignore California. Bay Area banks that may not consider themselves on the sales block could find they have suitors. That could include BNP Paribas, San Francisco-based Bank of the West, with $88 billion in assets and about 600 branches in the western United States. It has attractive concentration in the Bay Area and Los Angeles. Then there's Walnut Creek-based Mechanics Bank, with about $18 billion in assets and an expanding California branch network after its latest merger is completed. Already another round of consolidation is sweeping through banking, with the nation's 12th and 13th largest banks coming together as Atlanta-based SunTrust merges with the larger BB&T in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, to form a new bank called Truist. Maybe Fifth Third won't be the biggest bank with the oddest name, after all. Ohio ranks among the top 10 in the nation for green homes, a report says. A new report from the U.S. Green Building Council shows that Ohio ranks in the top 10 states for the number of LEED-certified homes. While the regional housing sector struggles with issues of low inventory and a lack of affordability, the overall market for sustainable housing has been gaining strength. USGBC, which created the Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design Rating System, released a report showing the number of LEED-certified homes in the United States are at an all-time high of 400,000 units, having increased 19% since 2017. Now California led the way for states with 39,296 units as of June of 2019, Ohio ranked number 7 with 7,402 units. Other states rounding out the list include Texas, New York, Washington, Colorado, New Jersey, Oregon, Maryland, and Georgia. And finally today, Fairfield. Well, let me start this way. These Cincinnati suburbs are among the easiest places in Ohio to sell a home. Do greater Cincinnati suburbs rank as the 10 easiest places to sell? That's according to a recent report. Fairfield was number 3. Forest Park came in at number 6 on a list created by New York-based financial technology company Smart Asset. The rankings were based on the number of days homes spent on the market in each area. In Fairfield, the average is 37.2 days. Forest Park, homes are on the market for an average of 43.6 days. Here's what it found in Fairfield. Owners lived in their home an average of 13.5 years. 9.5% of homes on average have negative equity. 6.1% of homes are decreasing in value. Homes cost are 18% of income. Oh, here's how Forest Park stacked up. Owners lived in their homes 14.5 years. 13.5% of homes on average have negative equity. 4.6% of homes are decreasing in value. Home costs are 23% of income. According to the study, Reynoldsburg, Ohio, is the easiest place in the state to sell a home. Residents there remained on the market for an average of 29.6 days. Columbus followed with an average of 36.9 days. Well, that brings to a close this week's program. You've been listening to the Greater Cincinnati Business Report here on Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati, a division of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. I'm Stephen J. Lowenstein. Thanks for listening. And join me next week at this very same time for another fun and exciting fact-filled edition of the Greater Cincinnati Business Report.